Between never-ending laundry cycles, Ethan, and incoming emails, you've got plenty on your list to do. I know. Give yourself one thing less to worry about and let DoorDash take care of your next meal. You want Chinese? You want pizza? Someone craving froyo? There's something for everyone on DoorDash. DoorDash is the app that brings you food you're craving right now, right to your door. Ordering is easy. Open the DoorDash app, choose what you want to eat, and your food will be left safely outside your door with the new contactless delivery drop-off setting. With over 300,000 partners in the U.S., Puerto Rico, Canada, and Australia, you can support your local go-tos or choose from your favorite national restaurants like Chipotle, Wendy's, and the Cheesecake Factory. Many of your favorite local restaurants are still open for delivery. Just open the DoorDash app, select your favorite local restaurant, and your food will be left at the door. DoorDash deliveries are now contactless to keep communities we operate in safe. Right now, our listeners can get $5 off and zero delivery fees on their first order of $15 or more when you download the DoorDash app and enter the code STRAUSS, STRAUSS. That's $5 and zero delivery fees on your first order when you download the DoorDash app in the App Store and enter code STRAUSS. Don't forget, that's code STRAUSS for $5 off your first order with DoorDash.
And so now you really have to face yourself in the mirror every day and look at the reality of what's here and the reality of what can be. And there are no, Josh mentioned at the start, this is a hard league. Everyone's trying to get the same thing. There are no silver bullets that make you do one thing and it makes it really easy overnight.
And a 5, and a 4, and a 3, and a 2, and a 1. Welcome to the House of Strauss podcast. I am very excited to announce our guest, one John Hollinger of, I believe it's The Athletic, yes?
Yes.
That great institution with all the best writing, including John's work, and a certain somebody else, Anthony Slater is the one I'm referring to. John, how are you doing?
Doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's I have many thoughts. I'm excited that the Warriors finally have a pick, and I think we'll get into that a little bit. It seems like there's clarity. There's the clarity for, and I want to. Did you coin the delete eight? Is that your coinage? Are you the one?
Yes, I'm the one to blame for that.
Well, it's a very good coinage, and you feel if your focus is primarily, and I write about broader NBA, but a little, primarily the Bay Area, you feel a little bit ignored. You know, I think it's a good thing that you're showing some attention to these forlorn teams that are on the outside, outside looking in. And it was, I mean, it was like rain in the desert to just finally, after months and months and months of knowing that the Warriors stunk, to finally get a sense of their draft pick. Quite clarifying, and there's just very little sustenance, I think, for the teams on the outside currently.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's only so much you can do, with a 7-part series about whether to pick up Juan Toscano Anderson's guarantee next year. So having another data point for even off-season discussion, I think, is very helpful.
Poor Slater. I do want to start off with some things you've been talking about because it's interesting to me, and I wonder. Okay, I'll put it to you this way. You've been writing about the Sixers of late because the process, as you say, is dead. It is over. It is finished. We have the firing. We have the firing of the coach. We've got a sense that they've reached their ceiling and they've squandered their assets. And I guess what I would put to you this way, John, do you think if you were looking at this through a Warriors lens, that there are any lessons right now as the Warriors sit on this precipice of win now versus nurture assets? Should the Warriors look at how the Sixers ran aground and say this means something to us, or was the Sixers situation and how it devolved unique to those circumstances?
I think the Sixers situation was driven by some impatience that maybe wasn't justified. Like, I think impatience is a little bit more justified in the Warriors' case. Like, Curry, Thompson, Green, like that clock is ticking, man. Whereas with Embiid and Simmons, right, they're still in their early 20s. So I actually think like moves as aggressive as the Sixers made are actually more logical from the Warriors' position than they were from the Sixers' position.
Hmm. I might push back on that a little bit. You know, okay. I'm thinking about one of the first things I learned from reading John Hollinger ESPN columns as a you know, as a college bum. One of the first things, and it's pretty intuitive, that you said is that shooting ability tends to extend a career, right? It tends to extend a career. I do not disagree that the Warriors are not on the front of their primes, or at least the most important ones, Steph and Clay. But maybe, just maybe, that window is a little bit lengthier than we might think. What say you to that? That you start seeing Steph maybe retain his form 2 to 4 years going forward?
Yeah, I mean, so their window as good players, sure. But as far as being that big three, that was the focal point of a title winning team that was just awesome and ran everybody off the floor. I mean, that's what they're trying to get back to, right? So I think to be at that level is a little more challenging and requires a little more immediate help. I see what you're saying. You know, you make the number two pick and maybe you get a player who can kind of take you into the next generation, your Kawhi to follow Duncan, so to speak.
Yeah. I'll frame it this way. I know what you're saying about how young the Sixers are, but I don't know if we know that that dynamic fundamentally works on a championship level, Embiid and Simmons. I don't know if it works. At least with the Warriors, even if what you're saying is true, that they are not going to be reaching a new peak, Steph and Clay, I at least know that works as a dynamic. And maybe that's why there is a little bit more cause for patience. And I might be speaking to my bias, John, because I love a draft pick. You know, I more favor doing that and just holding your nose and making the number two pick than necessarily trading for veteran help, unless that veteran help is Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Yeah. So one thing about making the pick is that the pick offers a store of value in a certain sense. In other words, you could take that player with you to the trade deadline and then probably still flip him and get, maybe you only get 90 cents on the dollar, but you'll get close to full value, and you'll know what you're getting, and you'll know what you have from Steph and Clay and Draymond when you've seen them play half a season together before the trade deadline, hopefully, if nobody breaks their hand in the first or third game or whatever. So there's an argument to be made for doing that, especially since you might have access to better players than you would right now. I don't see Giannis being available this summer, even if he doesn't sign the extension. I think it's actually, it might still be in Milwaukee's interest to not trade him at all. But you know, Beal, I think, is the other guy. Can you explain that one?
Because let's say Giannis says I'm leaving no matter what. Why would it be in their interest to not trade?
Did Toronto trade Kawhi?
They did not.
Would you agree Milwaukee will be one of the favorites to win the championship next year, regardless of whether Giannis signs an extension or not?
I might disagree. I don't know if I agree with that. I know that in terms of betting, they're in the top three favored teams, and I get that. And I look, I'm prepared to have egg on my face if I am wrong about this, but they are not a team I look at and go, that's a team that's winning a championship. Mm-hmm. I don't see enough offensive creativity or versatility that I think you need at the higher levels. And I have questions about the defensive strategy. I'm prepared to be wrong. I'm not coming at it arrogantly. I'm prepared to say I should have respected the net rating more so. But that at least is my assessment. And I don't think that is a narrowly shared assessment, especially among players. I think players tend to look at it as they don't have the guys. And, you know, that's something that I think informs the decision making, perhaps, of Giannis.
So setting aside whether he stays or not, I think any team, just by virtue of having Giannis on the team, you are immediately vaulted into the top five of contenders, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're Milwaukee, that might be worth just playing that out.
Yeah. just on the off chance, because the decision just resides in one man's mind, you know? So there is that component where even if he's steadfast and he's saying, no, I am not coming back, get me out of here, you know, maybe you tell yourself, hey, the upside is so worth it if he just changes his mind that we don't do his bidding. But, you know, the Toronto situation, I think, is a little unusual. In most cases, the teams cave and trade the guy who wants out. You know, they don't want the drama of it all, and they can actually get an asset for it, and they can make an agent happy who can maybe do them a favor down the line.
What favor is an agent doing you that is on par with having Giannis on your team? Like, oh man,
he played the agent. Yeah,
we got this guy for summer league. Like, we are set.
It's like Arn Tellem on steroids, this agent, to be able to to be able to make up like that favor.
Milwaukee
right there
is never getting a player like this ever again. Right, unless they luck into him in a draft again, right? But like in free agency or whatever, it's not happening.
Yeah, but wouldn't you? I mean, it's interesting. Do you think that Toronto has any regrets about how they played it, or that was the correct decision for
none.
Them?
I think if they had known beforehand that they would win the championship and Kawhi would leave afterward, that they would have taken that.
Yeah. Oh no, that's makes a tremendous amount of sense. And you know, as much as I might tweak Canadians about how they would have rather lost and have Kawhi validate Canada and Toronto and say that he is now an honorary Canadian and they wanted that all along, I do think as a team that all worked out. In fact, that's a dumb question by me. So I will move down the line and just say, so that's interesting. You know, that's an interesting picking your brain from having been in a front office, that the idea of not caving, the idea of just taking it down to the wire no matter what. Do you think, though, that there is a seriousness and a finality, the sort of finality that Anthony Davis gave the Pelicans, which does force your hand? Because Kawhi didn't give the Raptors that. They thought he was gone, but I don't think it was that level of finality. You know, if that comes, you know, do you want to really drag that out months and months and months? Is that worth it? I guess it just comes down to the attitude of the owner.
Yes, and a little bit the attitude of the player, whether he's like, get me out of here and I'm shutting it down. That can shift things a little bit if the player himself goes into kind of turns his pilot light off, so to speak. I mean, I think the Davis situation was easier for New Orleans because they weren't good enough to win big anyway. But what makes the Giannis situation tricky is you have a team that will be favored to have, okay, let me put it this way, will be an overwhelming favorite to have the best record in the Eastern Conference if they bring it back, right? And so you're going to trade yourself out of that? Like that's what makes that a little interesting.
That does make it a little bit different, a little bit interesting. In a way, Giannis' situation is almost a hybrid of Kevin Durant's Thunder situation and Anthony Davis's Pelican situation, where you have a team that is at that top level where they can conceivably compete for a championship that will mar your reputation if you shut it down and if you quit on them. That will follow you to a degree, but they do not have the fervent fan base of an Oklahoma City. They just don't. And I don't want to offend any rabid Bucks fans out there. Shout out Ben Thompson. I don't think that there is a huge population of people who are going to really rub it in Giannis's face in the way that it was rubbed in the face of Kevin Durant. And there's also more of an understanding, and this is a little bit more like the Pelicans situation. There's more of an understanding that he doesn't have the co-stars. You know, Joe basketball fan might see the Milwaukee Bucks record and think one thing, but he also goes, okay, but, you know, Chris Middleton is the next best player, or, you know, whoever you want to pick for the Bucks. And I at least think that there's going to be more understanding. I know I sound like a big Warriors honk right now trying to shove Giannis out of Milwaukee, but that's why I find it intriguing. That's why I find it interesting to discuss, because I do think there's an argument for the Bucks doing what the Raptors did and holding strong. But I also think there's an argument for Giannis doing what Anthony Davis did in a way and saying, screw it, I'm going to take the hit to my reputation. Nobody cares anymore that Davis did that to the Pelicans. I mean, it doesn't seem like it followed him. It seems like he's living the good life. I wonder if somebody like Giannis sees that and takes a lesson from it.
Perhaps. I mean, we really don't know what he's thinking, and we don't know we also don't know where he wants to go. Like you're saying, oh, Warriors, like, I mean, the team that he's been linked to the most is probably Toronto. And then
yeah, the Masai connection.
The New York stuff is not going to go away, even though I don't know why anyone would choose to play for that franchise. So there's going to be other stuff out there, and there's going to be other teams that could.
Wasn't the idea that like Masai would go to the Knicks and then they'd get Giannis? I mean, I think that was the whole idea.
Yeah, that was one that became popular before the Leon Rose hire. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, credit to the Knicks. They always have the best dreams. You know, they're leading the league in dreams. They're leading the league in hope. So, yeah. No, I think it's a really interesting situation to see it play out. And it's quieted down a little bit since the Bucks restored order. And, you know, as much as it looked like we might see some upsets in the bubble, and you had the Lakers and the Bucks drop their game ones, it seems like it's getting a little bit more on track, and there's not going to be as much trouble in paradise as it continues. So yeah, I mean, that's certainly one that I'm monitoring. I do want to get back a little bit to the process, because I think you did something really interesting in that article. I liked it a lot.
Thank you.
Was it a postmortem on the process? Is that what we're calling it?
Yeah, sure. Sure. I mean, eulogy? I said the process was dead, so it was literally, I guess, right?
The process is dead. Long live the process.
This is the year they burn through the last of the assets. Like, they have the 4 second round picks this year, and then going forward, they have the same draft equity that everyone else has. So they kind of burned through all the stuff that was accumulated in the Hinkie years. And really, they started that with Embiid and Simmons, and they left it with Embiid and Simmons.
That is very, very, very important to me. We talk a lot about process, not outcome, and about trying to consistently take all the best information you can and make consistently good decisions. And sometimes they work and sometimes they don't, and you should reevaluate them all. Sometimes they work and sometimes they don't, and you should reevaluate them all.
Yeah, and I think you made a very interesting argument, because in a way you were defending the process, because there are those who say it didn't work. And the fact that it's ran aground, they've burned through the assets, shows the folly of it all. And Sam Hinkie is a false idol and whatnot. But you made this great point, which is that the NBA proved the process worked by intervening and shutting it down.
I think, fairly criticize some other things that happened while the process was going on. But the big picture idea of essentially going in reverse to get a bunch of high draft picks, that was totally validated. And the league proved that again by changing the lottery odds. I mean, I alluded to this in the article, but I mean, in Memphis, we were kind of doing the same thing, and other teams we were quote unquote competing against were very clearly doing it too in 2018 with that great draft. To get as high as possible. And you haven't seen it as much the last 2 years. I mean, the drafts haven't been as strong maybe, but also they've really taken out a lot of the incentive at the margins. You're still going to see teams rebuild. You're still going to see teams hold out players with injuries late in the season, just because it's not worth it to potentially damage an asset for the following season. But it's the level of egregiousness, I think, has been truncated, which is good.
So are you ready to declare tanking dead then, that it's just the league has done enough by skewing the odds as they have in the lottery?
I think tanking as a strategy has been mortally wounded. Yeah. I mean, rebuilding is still a strategy, but just abject tanking and saying we're going to be horrible and just try to get the number one pick every year, like, the odds just aren't in your favor enough to try that.
In a way I applaud the league for pulling that off, because I do agree that they've mitigated it, but also in another way I'm just shaking my head because it took so long to solve this obvious insane problem in the overlong season, where fans are emotionally conflicted about their team winning and don't know whether to cheer it or boo it. It's amazing to me that it took as long as it did, but I think better late than never, I suppose. And I know Warriors fans aren't complaining because it actually stinking actually worked out for them. I think this is a good draft to have the number two pick. I think this is a good number two pick draft.
I think so. Now who do we like here though? I mean, it's a guard heavy draft and the Warriors are a guard heavy team. Like if there was a 3-4 that was available and that everyone said was a top two player, I think if you're a Warriors fan, you're like, awesome. Yes. That really isn't there in this draft.
Yeah, this draft is weak on the wings. And the next draft, incredibly strong on the wings, in theory. So that is suboptimal for the Warriors, who do need to supplement their wing quotient. And every team does. It seems like titles are won through the wings. And ever more bedeviling, it seems like wings might take a little longer to develop than maybe the other position. So it further complicates the picture for a win now Warriors. I read what you said about you can get centers cheaply. So maybe it's not the smartest thing in the world to go Wiseman. You know, maybe that's more 2007 thinking than 2020 thinking. And I agree with that. But then the other issue, of course, is do you want to get one of these guys who's going to be on the ball too much and not helping you? I'm a little more inclined to go that route. You know, I don't rate LaMelo as high as mm-hmm. you do, but I like the idea of getting a guard, a playmaker. I think they need another playmaker. And I think you do want to start building that bridge. You do want to build that bridge to the future right now. And if you don't think it's possible to get Giannis or whatever else, or I don't know, like if Paul George falls into a funk and wants to leave or whatever, I do think you should maybe take your best shot, make this pick, hope this pick helps you soon enough, and trade the next pick, the Timberwolves pick, the next season, because that's another year of waiting on development. Yeah. And it is maybe even more, I don't know if it's a more coveted asset than number two, now that it's officially number two, but people salivate over that draft, at least according to what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the T-Wolves pick is that you just don't know what they're going to be next year. Like, they might be good enough that it ends up being like a blah, like, you know, well, you know, 11th pick, great, you know? So,
yeah.
In that case, you know, the two is really the asset. Even though next year's draft is perceived to be stronger at the top, I mean, the Minnesota pick's top three protected. So you're not getting Cade Cunningham out of it.
It's big protection.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a big protection. Yeah. Somebody from the Warriors was bemoaning that and texting me after seeing the clips for the first time of Cade Cunningham and going, "Oh my god!" But at least you could dream on that.
Yeah.
You know, that potential would be incredible. And he's drawing, who knows, but he's drawing Luka comparisons right now. You know, it's one of the, I don't, people always say generational and they overuse that. I think that might be once every 3 years kind of pick. And so, yeah, I guess the second pick has more value than the theoretical Timberwolves pick now that it is settled at second.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the T-Wolves pick unprotected the following year if Minnesota ends up in the top three. But if Minnesota ends up in the top three and they already have Towns and Russell and they're trying to kind of build around them anyway, by 2 years from now, they're probably actually halfway decent. So
I'm crazy here. People are going to make fun of me if it doesn't work and if he turns into the French Cameron Payne. I just go Killian Hayes. That's my favorite. That's my favorite player I've seen.
And you then know, he turns I'm around no fancy, and calls him the French I'm no fancy Cameron scout. Payne. Wow.
Well, that's because you know what it is. It's your co-host Nate Duncan scared me months ago because he saw a clip of him. And was like, oh, it doesn't really have a right hand. You know, it kind of reminds me of Cameron Payne. And when he said that, I got worried. Like, oh my god, the French Cameron Payne. Oh no.
Welcome to the House of Strauss on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Stars hang with stars. Winners hang with winners.
Process, not alcohol.
I think he's a little more skilled than that. I think he's a little more skilled than campaign with the step backs and the side steps.
Well, he's bigger too.
The finish. He's big. He's six. That's what I also like. And I like the defensive motor. Not the fastest player, but I think my bias is more often to try to take the production over trying to extrapolate on the athleticism. And I just, the passing is great. I mean, LaMelo's the best passer in the draft, but I think Hayes is second. And I also, I have a lot more faith that Hayes is going to hit off the dribble threes than I do for LaMelo. And I have a lot more faith in Hayes' ability to impact the game defensively than I do for LaMelo. But a lot of people disagree. Why do you have LaMelo number one? What's the assessment?
I just think he can do things that other players in the draft just can't. I think he, I think the defense will come around once he actually tries. I think he's just never had to, he's just never had to try on defense. And you see that with some players sometimes. I mean, Ben Simmons was kind of like that at LSU, and now he's a freaking monster. DeJounte Murray was like that at Washington. I think that part will come around. Really plus rebounder for the guard position, which is nice because he starts his own breaks. I think he can he's a guy who can maybe weaponize the Warriors transition game a little more, which was something that they that they really had in that, you know, 2015, 2016, especially when they were just so fast end to end and we get so many transition threes on you. It was just frightening. So you like that about him. Fit in the half court is a little odd. What does he do when he doesn't have the ball in his hands is a little questionable.
It's a lot of floppy, a lot of floppy action with Clay and Steph. LaMelo pounding the ball at the top of the circle. But you're kind of intriguing me, you know? You're intriguing me, and I'm wondering, what the hell am I doing? I want to cover something interesting in the Bay Area. I want LaMelo Ball out here. That's something to write about. That's something to talk about. And if I'm not being tongue-in-cheek, from the perspective of an asset, and this is a weird way to think about it, you know, in theory, you should just think, who is going to add the most wins to what we're doing? But if I'm thinking about the number two pick as a potential asset, I feel like if LaMelo pops, he's even more of an asset than the other guys because of the built-in stardom. And that's also something I'm now thinking about as well, since it just seems like Bob Myers is not thrilled about making this pick. It's not too hard to read.
I do think the tradability of the player, like even if they do pick, has to weigh for them a little bit, and that a perimeter will be more tradable than, say, Wiseman or Okongwu, just because there's a more limited market for bigs. What about Edwards, though? Because, I mean, he's a guy who can just – I mean, you just plug him in at the two right away, right?
I was surprised because you wrote about Edwards and you wrote about – a lot of the deficiencies, and then to see you back on the Edwards bandwagon, I'm very curious what happened, John. You know, how did Edwards woo you? Explain it to us.
I looked at the other players available in the draft. I mean, he's going to score. He has the physical tools to be a good defender. There's definitely a lot of Wiggins in his game right now, which is a little scary because you already have the original Wiggins on your team. I thought
Harrison Barnes is the original Wiggins.
Yeah, that's true. It's kind of a generational thing with Golden State, I guess. His physical tools are so impressive that I think you just say, I don't know what he's going to be when he's 25. I see all the things that he does wrong right now, but I can see an avenue where he's awesome when he's 25. And for a lot of the other guys in the draft, you're just saying, okay, I see what you do well, but you will never be awesome.
Yeah. Well, you're trying to get Steve Kerr killed, number one. You know, I feel like between pushing for LaMelo and pushing for Anthony Edwards, but at least from a talent and asset perspective, there's certainly an argument to be made. And, you know, some guys, I like them or I'm okay with them, but there's just... you don't see that star potential for Okoro, for instance. You know, you're looking at him and going, I hope this guy can be Andre Iguodala, which would be fantastic if he actually turns into that. But it's almost like that shouldn't be your ceiling on a number two pick. And You know, I'm trying to think if there are any other guys that you feel like could change a franchise. And like you, I do gravitate more towards the perimeter player. I think just playmakers are so much more valuable, perimeter playmakers, than other players right now in the modern NBA. And not just in terms of wins, but in terms of trade value. And so I would rather swing for the fences. And again, I know I'm this crazy person saying Hayes, and I'm prepared to be mocked for all eternity, but that's one of the reasons. That's one of the reasons. If you like somebody and you think that they're a perimeter player, their ceiling is so much higher than some of these other bigs, even if I'm impressed by and like an Okongwu.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I see it, especially for a team like Golden State, that where the possibility of trading the pick, I think, is just out there on the table as a thing that could definitely happen within the next year. The Ball and Edwards are just going to have way more trade value than your other options.
Yeah, and you could also make the argument that the Warriors are a good situation for potentially pumping up somebody's trade value. That being flanked by Steph and Clay will probably get you more space, more openings, more ability to score than perhaps some other situations. I don't know if that's true. It seems a little wishful thinking, thinking-ish, but you know, I think that there could be something to that, and I think there could be something to that, and I wasn't terribly impressed by James Wiseman's three NCAA games. You know, it's not a lot to go on. Yeah. I mean, it's a tough draft.
I attended one of them in person, the one against Oregon, and I feel the same way. And then his AAU numbers aren't like as dominant as you would hope.
No. I mean, they're nothing compared to Marvin Bagley's, you know.
Yeah.
Bagley was an AAU monster compared to Wiseman. And yeah, I had the same feeling when I looked at Wiseman's AAU numbers. And this is where we are in this draft. People, you know, people might mock and they might question this. You know, I was on a podcast where this was instantly made fun of. And then my retort is, well, what the fuck else am I supposed to go off of?
Yeah.
What else do we have? We have what we have. Yeah. We have two NCAA games against absolute tomato cans that might as well have been high school teams. And one game against one real team in Oregon. That's what we got. So considering that the AAU games do have some predictive power, I am going to be a little bit worried that his numbers aren't dominant for his size against high school level competition. You know, if that's all I got, then I'm going to be worried. If I had a year of him completely dominating at the NCAA level, then forget the AAU stuff. But for him, the AAU stuff is the bulk of the data.
That's what you have to go on. Yeah.
Yeah. And with him, some of it's decision-making. He does some weird stuff, man, at least in that game where he'll do mid-range fadeaways when nobody's around. Maybe I'm reading too much into that, but it was just strange to me. It didn't look like the kind of feel or motor I got from Okongwu.
Oh, totally. No, they're totally different players that way. I mean, Okongwu, when he plays, he reminds you a lot of Bam Adebayo.
Yeah.
And Wiseman reminds you more of Hassan Whiteside. Mm. And I'm trying to give you archetypes and not necessarily say one is going to turn out like one and one is going to turn out like the other. But Wiseman is much bigger. But his motor doesn't run as hot and he does some things that are going to make you scratch your head. Whereas Okongwu is smaller, a little quicker, has great hands. And is more like just active the whole game. So it's going to be interesting to see how those two guys turn out and which one ends up better.
Yeah, I don't know if Okongwu necessarily has the athleticism of a Bam. There's something to the way Bam moves where there's like a slickness that's almost guard-like in the way that he moves that I don't know that Okongwu has. I do have some hope for the Okongwu three-pointer, even if he shot, God, I don't know off the top of my head, maybe three of them, but the shot looks good to me. And
I think he'll shoot well enough. Like I don't know if he's going to make threes as a rookie, but by the time he's 25, I think he will.
Yeah. Yeah. I project that as well. And I think with him, there's also a little bit of versatility where yes, to what you're saying, it is true. The bigs have less value, But if you can guard a bunch of different positions, then you're almost a different kind of big. And I see him as somebody where you can slide in between the four and the five, yeah. and you can potentially switch one through five. And for the Warriors, especially how they've done things, I think that's somebody who could provide a lot of value there.
Yeah. I think he's a good fit with Golden State, which brings up an interesting question we haven't talked about. You know, you're allowed to trade down.
What? Are you making trade down and get my beloved Killian Hayes? I'm in.
You could almost certainly trade down and get Killian Hayes based on what's out there right now.
Well, let's talk about who are your sleepers then. You know, who are you looking at who aren't necessarily falling in that top three strata where you think you get some good value?
I have Hayes third on my board, so I would say him. I would say Okongwu, who I had him fourth, if I remember right. I would say those are the two main ones. And then if you had a trade down where you were really getting a good piece back and you could also draft Devin Vassell, who probably has a lot of win now value for a team, because he's just absolute ready-made 3-and-D guy, I think that might have some currency with the Warriors too. 16-game player, so to speak, except he's actually good.
You remember that. Well, I think, do you have to worry about that as when you're involved in a team that we're going to overcorrect for the big disaster we just had? Is that something that you ever worry about? Because I think that with the Warriors right now, you almost have to worry that you're going to overlearn the lesson of Jacob Evans and the next kind of guy who's provides defensive value and does a bunch of different things, that you're going to be scarred by that. Is that something that you have to guard for when you're involved in team decisions?
Yeah, probably a little bit. You know, that's the, you know, like they say, everyone, you know, we fight every war as if it's the last one, right? And so yes, I don't think it's endemic to just...
It's had the... they had the French troops doing bayonet charges in World War I into artillery, I think, was anyway, sorry, you were saying. I got distracted, John. Continue.
Why do you hate the French?
I look, I'm a big Killian Hayes fan. Okay.
All right. Okay. I take it back.
You fight every war like it was the last war. You know, it's you get a certain archetype and you don't want to go through that. But you were saying.
I don't even remember what I was saying.
Manscaped is here to provide you the best tools for your grooming experience. The Lawnmower 3.0 is the best hygiene tool for the modern man. I have one and it works wonderfully. I've been big on this for a long time. Keep yourself trimmed. It's just a great feeling. I highly recommend this product. And you can use it in the shower. Because of their ceramic blade and skin-safe technology, your snags will be reduced. They actually just released the Shears 2.0 Nail Kit, which is the perfect add-on to their Lawnmower 3.0 trimmer. The Shears 2.0 is a luxury four-piece nail kit featuring tempered stainless steel tools, and it includes slash tip tweezers, rounded point scissors, fingernail clippers, and a medium grit nail file. Their perfect package 3.0 comes with a new and improved lawnmower, waterproof, cordless, body trimmer, performance boxer briefs, and travel bag for you to use when we are done quarantining. The perfect package 3.0 also comes with a crop preserver and crop reviver. The Crop Preserver is an anti-chafing deodorant. Crop Reviver is a spray-on toner. It's made with soothe aloe and witch hazel extracts. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code THEATHLETIC20 at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use the code THEATHLETIC20. Take your grooming game to the next level.
Welcome to the House of Strauss on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Long story short, I have this powerful memory of people being so wedded to archetypes and how to fight a war that I believe in World War I, the French were doing bayonet charges into German artillery and, you know, eventually wised up. How that benefits us in this draft conversation, I am not sure. I just know that the Warriors are scarred by Jacob Evans, and I wonder if that is maybe informing the buzz about Wiseman a little too much and the idea that we need to get a center. And I think they should be cautious because it's not like their track record on drafting centers is good either of late.
Well, really, I mean, of late, I mean, we can go back to like Todd Fuller, can't we?
Patrick O'Brien. Yeah, I mean, it hasn't been good, and it's almost their white whale in a way.
Yeah.
And I think it is a position that Steve Kerr wants filled.
So do they see Draymond as their four?
I think they see him as their five, but they're worried that it will kill him.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's how they see
okay.
it. You know, they see it like a situation where this is our running back, but he can't get 80% of the carries. This is our catcher, but we're going to need at least two other catchers. I think that's the way they see it.
Yeah. Okay.
And you know, I think that they would struggle if he was there for.
I think if you need a center who's going to be like your center, but not really your playoff center, you can get that player with your taxpayer mid-level.
What do you make? Now I'm just going down your board because I love this stuff. What do you make of Aaron Nesmith? Because that's another guy where it's not Wiseman-esque as far as the blank, the blankness of the sample size or the truncated sample size. But we don't have a lot to go on, and he's just somebody where, I mean, it looks really cool when he's just killing mm-hmm. it and tearing the net down and shooting off the dribble. But it's against competition that stinks. And you know, is this a guy where potentially stardom could come from there?
Stardom, probably not, but like pretty goodness, like helpfulness. Yeah, I mean, he can stroke it. I don't know, like defensively, he should be probably competent, but not amazing. I don't think he can do enough on the ball to have like real stardom. But I mean, him and Clay and Steph running off of pin downs. I mean, my goodness.
Okay, now I'm just going down the list. I just love this, man. I love the shitty draft. I'm so into this shitty draft. We both like Paul Reed. I don't know if you trade down to get a Paul Reed if you're the Warriors, but we're both into his sleeper potential. Mm-hmm. What do you? Another guy I don't know a lot about, Poku. Like, what do you make of Poku? You know, what's the? I see blurry images from dirty gymnasium.
He's the swing for the fences where you're trying to get another Giannis out of it, but you might. You know, you might end up getting Yaroslav Korolev out of it instead. He's just
a
huge variance. Some of the stuff he does on tape is really good. He's playing against dudes like you and me. He's definitely really skilled for his size, but he's super skinny, struggles to hold his position even against the sort of rec league level competition he's playing against over there. And he's also the youngest player in the draft. So I think he's a super high variance guy. He makes more sense to me when you start getting into like the 12 to 15 range where the guys you have a pretty decent idea will at least be okay or off and you're really starting to throw darts. Yeah. Cause he's got by far the highest upside of any of the dart throws.
Yeah. I mean, that is sort of the Giannis range. I'm trying to remember, where was Giannis picked?
What 15.
Was the
Giannis draft? It was 2013.
15. Wow. Wow.
I think it was 15.
Yeah, I guess that is.
Yeah.
I guess that is the Giannis range, and Poku does play in the Greek second division. So, yeah, that one's really interesting. And I'm sort of looking at this with an eye towards the Warriors. You know, when I'm looking at your list right now. I'm looking at your overall board. What do you make of Halliburton? That's another one that's interesting. That's a sort of an analytics versus eye test.
I like him. I think he's a combo. I think he's not truly a lead guard. He doesn't quite have that burst to create a bunch of shots on his own, but good shooter, good passer, really long, reads the game well, not super great laterally just on his own, like defending in an island, but really good team defender, gets his hand on a lot of balls. I think he's going to end up being a winning player. And like he definitely would fit Golden State. Yeah. Cause you could play him at the two and maybe play him as a backup one. And I think he'd be fine.
Yeah. I mean, he's really bad when he runs pick and roll is my one knock or my main knock on him. But I love the intelligence and the passing ability is great. And the 3-point shot looks a little goofy, but it goes in, or a little flat, but it goes in. And you know, he just seems like a smart winning player, and maybe that's subjective, but that's, I wouldn't feel, I wouldn't feel bad if I were the Warriors if maybe I traded down a little bit and got him to supplement. It seems like he's somebody who could probably provide value quicker than some of the other perimeter guys they could take in this draft. Obi Toppin is another guy I'm intrigued by. He's somebody where I feel like if his block steal rate was just jacked up a little bit, I would go, that's the number one pick. You know, that's, but you know, what is he? He's like at a block and a steal a game. He sort of has this upright posture, which you wonder if he could, you could really switch. And he's not really the height of a center, you know, but he's a great rim runner, and that 3-point shot looks clean. And I mean, he's the best, I think, probably by far the best offensive player in college basketball. So what do you make of the chance that Toppin actually becomes, you know, that becomes a star, or at least becomes a really good player?
I think he could become a really good player, especially at the offensive end. There's concerns about the defense. I actually think he wasn't as bad in switches as people thought. In pick and roll, he was, but some of that, I think, is feel and repetition that might get better. People forget what a project he was to get to this point, even though he's an older player at 22, last season was really his first one playing any kind of big time basketball, and he's been on such an improvement track. And then offensively, he's got the whole package in terms of he can hit a three, he's a pretty good passer, he can put it on the floor, and if you switch a small on him, he will reliably murder that switch in a post up. A lot to like there offensively.
I kind of wonder what are we doing here? I mean, should he be higher up in this draft? And you know, if you're the Warriors, I do think about it this way too. If we're making the argument that they can open up more for a standard pick, right? You know, this is the idea that maybe they could boost LaMelo's trade value more because you'll have more space. You think about Steph and Klay flanking Obi Toppin and pick and roll, and I have to say that is tantalizing.
Yeah,
that's mighty tantalizing in that setup.
Yeah, that would be pretty unguardable. That's a pretty decent argument, and you could probably go down to like four or five and pretty reliably get him. So
just him and DHOs with Curry. I mean, that's, I'm getting intrigued, John. I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
Just one more steal or one more block a game, and I'm totally all the way in. Well, that's something we should maybe explain to people, because people ask, why block and steal rate? That's not something that's intuitive to people as a metric, the steal rate especially has been
shown to be pretty predictive of draft success, to the extent that anything is. We're all dumber on the draft than we'd like to admit, but steal rate has been shown to be an indicator stat, let's say, where it's more predictive maybe than some of the other stuff you might think would be predictive, like, I don't know, points per game. I mean, still the most predictive thing is still, ironically enough, how good were they at basketball, right? But when you start parsing through the stats, the individual stat that has some of the most predictive value is actually steals.
What are the main ways that teams select a bust? You know, what are the main reasons they are snookered in your experience, having been on the other side?
So I think an important piece of this is that teams still have agency over how the pick develops after the pick is made. In other words, what you do with that player after you get him has a material impact. So I think that part can't be ignored and from the player development side and from the physical development side. That said, I think, I mean, draft history tells us that teams, even though teams get criticized every year for passing on prominent seniors when they end up becoming good players, the overall history says that teams still haven't quite been age biased enough, and that going younger has tended to work out a lot better. I think draft workouts are an interesting one.
Yeah, the Warriors, I mean, maybe it was good that they passed on Andre Drummond, but I remember the reason why they didn't get Drummond is because his draft workout was so awful.
Yeah.
And maybe that would have been a better pick than Barnes. Really hard to argue with it. It's kind of 6-1, half dozen the other between those guys. And the Warriors won a few championships, so it all worked out. And, you know, now you're declaring that whoever gave Drummond a Defensive Player of the Year vote should be banished from, I think, polite society or all society, whatever you're saying. I knew I shouldn't. I mean, it was a ballsy pick by me. I'm a contrarian, John. What can I say? I had to be. No, I don't know who made the pick. But so, yeah, but that's one that sticks in my mind where there are these moments that teams don't typically talk about where the workout determines the pick. But these GMs, they want to feel, they want to breathe the same air as the pick, which these days you can't do. And I think that they you wonder if there's almost like a little bit of mission creep in some cases where you have to do your due diligence. It would be irresponsible not to see the workout. But then there is this mission creep of wanting to lean more heavily on it than you should.
You know what's so hard, though, is that it's the last thing you saw before the draft. That's what makes it so hard. And that's why... That's why, I mean, I've debated with people whether you should do workouts at all. Is the clouding that it'll put in your head worth it for the information you gained from it?
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, you know, maybe it's weird because you want to do due diligence. More information has to be good, theoretically. You want more information, but... You do wonder if you are seeing somebody in a setting that isn't a basketball game and you are primarily drafting them on their ability to perform well in basketball games, if it hurts more than it helps because of the recency bias.
Yeah.
So maybe this draft counterintuitively, John, will be one of the most accurate.
Yeah, we might not screw it up, huh? It'll be an interesting test case.
I mean, that I kind of doubt it just because there's so much flux in this shitty draft.
Yeah.
And I say shitty, I don't know if it's shitty, but shitty in terms of, it's shitty in this way. It's shitty in the way of nobody knowing, you know, it's shitty in the way of there not really being tiers, you know, and certainly if you got the number one pick, you wish that it was a situation like Anthony Davis in 2012 where, well, no more decision making, but no, you got a lot of decisions to make if you're the Minnesota Timberwolves.
Yeah, they're in an interesting spot.
God, what did they do, by the way?
Because you already have Russell, and so Edwards definitely fits better than LaMelo does there. But I like LaMelo a little better. I know you would take Hayes, right?
I mean, I would take Hayes in any situation. I mean, that's if I'm, you know, in the Bundesliga, if I'm, you know, if I'm if I'm playing soccer, I mean, just really, I haven't really thought about
it. Why are you such a Francophile?
I took French. I foolishly took French in middle school. It was, again, this is the unfortunate contrarian thing. Everybody took Spanish and I said, no. I don't care if I live in San Diego. I'm going to learn French like an idiot. And I need to get something out of it, John. You know, it was a foolish decision back then. But if I could just exchange a few words with Killian Hayes, it might be of some material benefit to my job. So it's really the long game that I'm playing. But from the Timberwolves perspective, I looked at it more as, okay, the Warriors are likely to get Wiseman. That's what I looked at it as, because getting Wiseman or getting a big makes zero sense if you're them. But actually answering the question of which guy they should get is a little bit trickier. And I suppose Edwards makes the most sense, you know? But this goes back to, this isn't a great draft to get the number one pick. You're almost saddled with it.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, could you see any team wanting to trade up for the number one pick? Or any team, like, you see any team having their heart set on anybody in this
particular
draft?
I could see,
like,
the Knicks trying to trade up to number one to get LaMelo.
Yeah. But what do they have?
Their future picks.
Their future picks.
I mean, that basically.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just if you're a Wolves fan, I don't know. I guess Edwards, you know, I wasn't a huge fan, but just based on talent alone. And then, I mean, this goes back to, I'm not so confident that they're going to make the playoffs next season. I just think defensively, if you're anchoring your defense around a lot of minutes for Towns, a lot of minutes for Russell, a lot of minutes for Edwards, I don't know.
No, they're not going to, not in the West, certainly.
And that's one of the reasons.
And I think they know that, though. They're trying to build for 2-3 years out around that core, but a better version of that core. But I mean, I don't think they're looking at this as like the completion of the task. Let's say, I mean, they're still going to make other moves from here. So I just think they want to get the best talent, but I think there is a little bit of a concern that LaMelo and D'Angelo might subtract from each other enough that Edwards would appear to be the best talent, I guess. You know what I mean? In that environment. So.
Yeah. It's a tough one. Well, I'll end on the, well, first I want you to explain, I want your reaction to the McMillan firing. That's what I want. I want a quick hitter on that. You had an interesting tweet of having been informed about McMillan and D'Antoni. Were you shocked by that? You know, were you shocked by that decision by the Pacers?
I was surprised, but I wasn't completely floored. Their recent playoff record probably weighed on it a little bit. But there was the announcement of the extension, right? Because I had thought he was probably in hot water, even though they'd had a good year. And then when the extension happened, I said, okay, I guess not. But I don't know if, I mean, that's a pretty quick change of mind, right? To have that extension happen. And then
I feel bad for these coaches that went to the bubble and got fired. I mean, I would be very annoyed to drag my ass in this hermetically sealed environment, this crazy situation. Yeah. And, oh, I'm sorry that I didn't perform well enough in bizarre synthetic basketball.
Right. Right.
I'm sorry. You know, I would have rather have been told before all of this, you know, having to prove my worth in this just crazy scenario. But it's interesting. And, you know, you could see it coming with the Gentry Pelican situation. And I guess maybe these coaches were dead men walking going into the bubble, but it's weird to think that they could potentially have salvaged anything in a scenario that you would think you would just throw away.
Yeah, I guess it's hard because like McMillan did objectively a good job, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
But the hard thing with being a coach in the NBA is that people always want more. And so he helped them be good enough to make them dissatisfied with how he coached them in the playoffs.
Yeah.
In a sense, right? So.
Yeah. I mean, that's the coach of the year curse, right?
Yeah.
I mean, coaches get fired by expectations.
Yes.
You know, you never know what the dynamics are behind the scenes. I know the Warriors, a lot of people ripped them when they fired Mark Jackson. I think that was probably a pretty good move. And so you never really know what's going on behind the scenes. But you can't be a victim of expectations or a meddlesome owner or whatnot. Okay. The thing to get you out on, I've always wondered, I feel in a way that the 2015 series between the Warriors and the Grizzlies is almost a little bit forgotten or not talked about enough. I felt like just being on the road and covering it, like it was a massive series. Like it felt as though a lot of things could have shifted in basketball and that the Warriors felt like they were coming apart at the seams and potentially crumbling. And then they just got it all together, I think, in a way that I think Ron Adams' decision to not guard Tony Allen was very influential as to how defenses would do things from there on out. And so I think about the series a lot, and I was just always curious, because I don't think we ever talked about it. What was that series like to experience from the other side?
Well, the thing nobody ever talked about was the injuries we had. I mean, part of the reason the Tony Allen strategy worked, I mean, it was a brilliant idea and it hadn't really been done before. But the other thing was that his hamstring that he hurt it making that steal from Clay in game two, and then he aggravated it in game three. And so he wasn't able to even, you know, try to do some of the things he might have done against Bogut to counteract that. And you could tell right away at the beginning of that game four, Clay comes wide open off a screen, which is the first time he'd been that open the whole series. And he actually stopped and looked behind him for Tony Allen as though the dude was going to jump off the scorer's table and block his shot. Because Tony to that point had just complete, I mean, he was the hardest player to screen off the ball in the whole league. And he just did a brilliant job, just took away all Clay's stuff. And so I thought that was a turning point. And then the other part people forget is, could we have won game one if we had had Mike Conley and Beno Udrih?
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to remember, did Conley break his face?
He broke his face in the Portland series. Yeah. CJ McCollum broke his face. And he came back and played game two, which is way earlier than we were expecting him. And that was a key reason we won that game, obviously. But as he kind of played that game on adrenaline, like he was still kind of messed up from that injury. And as the series went on, you kind of saw that a little more. So I just wish we had been 100% in that series. We probably still would have lost because the Warriors had an awesome team, but you're right. I mean, I was hearing the same stuff, like heading into that fourth game, especially that they were teetering a little bit, right?
Well, yeah, Steph was going to, was it the Blue City
Blue
Cafe?
Blue City Cafe, that sure. That probably the one place on Beale Street that locals like to go to. Good place, good catfish there.
Yeah, he was going to the Blue City Cafe and drinking wine to just try to get out of his head in the way that Paul George maybe has been trying to get out of his head. And they were rocked a little bit, and they were the better team, clearly. But they hadn't really had those expectations. They hadn't really been in a situation where if they failed, the nation would be laughing at them. And I think that stuff is real. And that was, it ended in a blowout, but I just remember, and it's so great how when you're media at FedEx, you get to sit courtside for a playoff game. And it's just incredible, just incredible atmosphere. And the tension in that moment, in that building, I think Steph had a dunk that he just kind of squeaked in right there. And I was thinking, oh, that's kind of ballsy, just considering everything riding on it. And it was just such an elevation of tension and then almost cathartic release for the Warriors, because you rarely see that absent a definitive injury, where it felt like the Tony Allen decision, the inability to really counter it. And after the game, one of the Warriors players was telling me it's over. The series is over. And just like that, within, you know, in the middle of a series, it had gone from extreme threat level to moving on to the next thing. Yeah. And it just all went like that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, that definitely was a turning point. And then Steph hit that 70-foot shot over Costa at the end of the third quarter in game six, which snuffed out our little rally to try to tie it up at three each.
Yeah, but it was hard fought. It was a very charismatic Grizzlies team, and you know, I do think that they, just through having a little bit more composure and less to lose, that there was a real opportunity there.
Yeah,
and history might have went another way. But that was, you know, sneakily one of the best series that I've been around was that particular series.
Sure.
You know, maybe not at the level of Warriors Thunder 2016 or, you know, Cavs Warriors, although a final series is just, it's kind of different. It's almost like covering a Super Bowl or being at a Super Bowl where you don't, it's almost a little too big in a weird way.
Yeah, that,
you know,
I agree. Like second round playoffs is perfect because there's not as much crush of other media. Like the bigness of it doesn't take away from it, but it's still, but it's still big, right? And so,
well, you know, if I'm at Quicken Loans for the finals, I'm just up in the rafters somewhere, in this big media section, versus, you know, I'm at Chesapeake Energy Arena or whatever it's called, and like FedEx, you're on the floor of it, and it is intense, and you've got that small town energy.
My last full year at ESPN, I covered the entire Memphis OKC series that went seven.
Oh,
you know, and just back and forth courtside the whole time. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, it's incredible. Well, hopefully we will be able to do that again, and hopefully when we can do it again, God willing, there will be media seating courtside, at least at some arenas.
Yes.
John, this was delightful and informative. We've done a lot to help whoever Killian Hayes' agent is, although we didn't really discuss it. We didn't really discuss his game or you having him high at number three. That's because we kind of agree. You know, I think we're both Hayes honks over here. Thanks so much for stopping by. You're welcome at any time. Is there anything you would like to plug?
Yeah, I just wrote about the Eastern Conference second round. And so that's out on The Athletic. And also some of the adjustments or non-adjustments that we've seen in the first round so far. So check it out. I make my pick for Celtics Raptors and Bucks Heat. Sorry, Orlando. I went ahead and did that. So it's all out there.
I'm intrigued to read that, and I apologize to everybody for not talking any playoffs. Next week, we will talk some playoffs. You know, it kind of settled, the playoffs did. The underdogs had, they kind of fell. Thanks so much, John. Thanks so much, Jade, super producer Jade Hoy. And thanks so much to all the readers and all the listeners. And we will be back with you next week. Jade?